The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney. Of course, David, on everybody's mind right now is that Osama is dead. Now, the question, after we go through the celebrations and the reflections and all the different things that we go through after a decade of dealing with this issue, is how relevant really is it, and what does it really reveal about what we should be doing as far as analysis for the future?
Well, Kevin, I think the question that's been asked by many people is, why are we in the Middle East? That's been asked many times. Why are we in Pakistan and Afghanistan? And we've had 10 years an excuse pursuing Al-Qaeda, and specifically...
Nothing like a bad guy to have to chase across the West, or the East in this particular case. And now that we've strung up the bad guy, what do we do next?
Right. I think, Kevin, it's always important to look at underlying stories when you are trying to judge political decisions,
right,
and even geopolitical decisions. You know, the classic example would be the Panama Canal. It was not supposed to go through Panama. And if you look at the lakes between the lakes that are strewn all throughout Nicaragua, that was the original plan.
Really?
There was very little excavation required to take the route through Nicaragua.
So Panama was never the original intention. It was Nicaragua. Well, what changed that thought process?
Well, it was actually an orchestrated revolution coming north from Colombia, combined with a major PR campaign directly to the House and the Senate. And Kevin, it was a masterfully done job. You know, for the details of the story, you could look at a chapter from Our Crowd, a book written, I think, in the 1960s. And it's a fabulous telling of the tale of how politics and money intertwine. And I think that may seem like a strange way to look at Osama being taken out of the picture.
Right.
But frankly, Kevin, when you look at Afghanistan, it's important to understand who their neighbors are and what role they've played in the last decade in the energy world. It's not actually Afghanistan that you should have your eye on. It's Turkmenistan. Turkmenistan has the fourth or fifth largest natural gas fields in the world.
Okay, so in other words, we again are taking our analysis to that three-letter word, oil, O-I-L.
Or natural gas, but it's energy. You know, the problem is Turkmenistan sits on the eastern side of the Caspian Sea. It's landlocked. It's not next to any place where they can back up a truck, so to say.
But they've got gas.
But they do have gas,
okay.
And the only way to move it is either by rail or by pipeline. So the traditional pipelines have gone north to Russia, and with the fall of the Soviet Union, that changed sort of the calculus, if you will. It became of greater interest to the west of the world where that natural gas flowed. It wasn't going to necessarily be or exclusively be to the Soviet Union. So there's been proposed pipelines, Kevin, from Turkmenistan. The most famous one is the TAPI, T-A-P-I, which stands for Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India pipeline.
So what we're talking about are all the countries, I mean, other than Turkmenistan. The other countries are the ones that we hear about in the news, why our military is stationed there, but the why is rarely ever talked about as far as oil or gas or pipelines. It's usually Osama, or terrorism, or Taliban, or Al-Qaeda.
Well, the Taliban were largely in control through the 90s in Afghanistan, Kevin. And, you know, so the negotiations for the TAPI pipeline going back into the 1990s, you had two groups, an Argentinian company and then a U.S. company, wink, wink, nod, nod, Unocal, which was vying for the rights to put in the TAPI pipeline and operate it. The interesting thing, Kevin, is that negotiations broke down with the Taliban July of 2001.
Okay, now wait a second. You're talking about negotiations between a U.S. company, an Argentinian company, and the Taliban? They were actually talking up through July of 2001.
That's right. So what's interesting is immediately following the 2001 invasion, so now we're post 9/11, so
right,
moving into 2002, really, the interim president, President Karzai, met with President Musharraf in Islamabad. This is February of 2002, and they announced their agreement to cooperate on the proposed pipeline. So you've got what went away as an option now back on the table as an option, and it looks like we're going to continue to move forward. So the real question I have, Kevin, is why are we in Afghanistan and Pakistan? Are we likely to leave the region given the fact that we have essentially a straw man,
right,
the reality is, now that he's gone, we're not likely to see a change in troop allocation from Pakistan and Afghanistan, insofar as we still have an interest in the Tabi pipeline, and seeing that it's operated in a way that doesn't change geopolitical calculus. You have to have certain players. In this case, the pipeline goes to India, ultimately, which, if you're looking at Asian calculus, we're more interested in enforcing, reinforcing the relationship with India. One of the proposed pipelines would actually go through Uzbekistan and go to China instead, which again leaves us in a lower power position, if you will. So if this can be orchestrated in such a way where we benefit, whether it is just that of leverage or actual cash flow through a U.S. corporation, that leverage is something to keep in mind.
Well, you know, something that's been interesting to me over the last 48 hours since we heard about Osama is I really thought my kids, who are in their young 20s, would have really keyed into this because they were 10 or 12 when 9/11 went off. But in reality, enough time has passed that they were introspective in completely different ways. And so, in a way, Osama, I don't want to say was old news, but he was an old excuse to be a place that we now have to come up with a new excuse. And so it will be interesting how this plays out, David.
Well, and the reason why we are champions of the Tabi pipeline is that the alternative, which New Delhi could consider, comes not from Turkmenistan, but from Iran. Hmm. So you go Iran, Pakistan, India, or Turkmenistan, Afghanistan, Pakistan, India. And if you can avoid going through Iran, there's obvious benefits in terms of U.S. foreign policy. We've been supporters of the Tabi pipeline, not the IPI pipeline. And this is, again, where was this about Senor Osama? No, in fact, he was, in my book, a straw man.
Well, then, taking it to the volatility that we're seeing in the market, because we're seeing analysis come out and they're going, oh, well, oil prices now are going to be on the downslide because Osama's dead, and you know, gold and silver are going to go down or what have you. We're going to have volatility in these markets and excuses for volatility in these markets, but we have to keep a broader perspective, do we not?
Well, and I think you could look at that in relation to the silver and gold market. We have something that's, okay, well, maybe this is a reaction to less tensions in the Middle East because we're now ahead of the curve in terms of our efforts with Al-Qaeda. And that's why gold and silver are selling off. The fear premium is being taken out of those markets.
Right.
No, not really. You know, the CME changed margin requirements twice last week and once this week. 9% increase, 10% increase, followed by an over-the-weekend announcement that went into place. And then finally, Kevin, the third announcement of a 12% hike to a maintenance margin and initial margin requirements.
Let's put that in perspective. Okay, to go out and buy a futures contract, you have to put a certain amount of money down, very much like a mortgage on a house. And when you've got that money riding, that market can go up. You can make quite a bit of money if you're long in that market, or it can go down. And if you were betting on the up, you can lose money. But what you're saying is the margin, the amount of money that the investor had to come up with, has been raised. That seems like manipulation, David.
Well, I like the housing analogy, Kevin, because basically what you have is, if this were to happen, theoretically, there's a parallel here. The bank calls you and says, well, you did put 25% down on your house as a down payment.
But we need more.
Send us an extra 9%.
Right.
And then the same week, send us an extra 10%. And then the next week, send us an extra 12%. And you're saying to yourself, well, I don't keep that kind of cash around. And here's the point. In the silver market, if you can't hold the position, if you don't have enough liquidity,
you've got to sell.
It forces a liquidation.
That's what happened to the Hunt brothers 30 years ago, David.
Well, and you can move margin to 100%, where you will go from a leveraged position, 5-1, to where you're not allowed any leverage at all, and you have to come up with a tremendous amount of capital, and it has everything to do with liquidity. This is the beauty, Kevin. This is the beauty of running the exchange.
Right.
If the house begins to lose, guess what the privilege is of those that run the house?
They can shut the game down.
Change the rules in the middle of the game. So it's fascinating.
David, you're going to be talking in Las Vegas here in just a few days. And it reminds me of these casinos where you walk in, and if you're losing money, they serve you free drinks. If you're winning money, the free drinks may slow down just a little bit. But if you're really winning money, they ask you to leave.
And they want to know who you are because they're going to keep an eye out for you, and they don't want you to return.
Well, okay. David, taking it from the volatility issue, there's been an area that a lot of people are saying will decrease volatility in the market, a change in Federal Reserve policy, where we actually have not a secretive Fed, but a very vocal Fed. And Ben Bernanke just came out and spoke. He said, this is what I'm going to do. What are your feelings? Does that remove volatility from the market?
Kevin, this is what we were talking about on our Friday comments. We write those on our wealth management website, mwealthm.com, if anyone's interested in reading them. But the gist is this, Kevin. You have the Fed, which has been very secretive since its founding in 1913, and it's really not the business of the market what the directors of the economy are going to do. Kevin, that's been a respected and appreciated position taken by both the general public and the Fed.
Well, partially because they have so much effect in the market. If somebody knows what they're going to do, they can actually, it's called discounting in the market, they can just go out and actually buy or sell what they need to be ahead of the game.
And I think, Kevin, what we end up having is academics who aren't necessarily market practitioners, not to discount their intelligence, highly intelligent, but so focused on one particular nuance of monetary management or fiscal management, as it were, that they don't see what the impact would be of transparency. And certainly at a popular level, you and I may want more information. We may feel that they've hidden things from us and therefore they should disclose. I think there's some benefit to us as individual citizens to know what they're doing.
As long as everybody knows at exactly the same time and has the same tools to react.
And our problem with the full disclosure is really this, Kevin. It's not as if we're just curious citizens. We're also curious speculators.
Sure.
And as curious citizens, it helps us sleep better at night knowing what's happening. In an age of deceit and lies, transparency and truth is like a salve. We feel comfortable with what they're doing. That has its own merits, and I think they're using that to their advantage. But the disadvantage, Kevin, is that we're equally speculators. Give me information as to how the economy is going to be managed, and I know how to leverage a bet.
Sure.
Kevin, so what happened here with an academic doing what appears to be the right thing in terms of transparency is reminiscent, Kevin, of what happened in 1999 when Alan Greenspan was making the best efforts to say, the derivatives market is a wonderful thing. It's going to reduce risk in the marketplace by allowing investors to choose what portion of risk they want to take on and what portion they want to sell off and allow someone else to shoulder. So essentially, we're sharing the risk versus having one institution bear the full brunt of one particular calamity. So in theory, just as our current Fed president is doing, in theory, judging and appraising the situation and moving forward with a new policy, we had that same thing initiated actually before 99. He just gave public comment to it. The problem was, in actuality, we've seen a market go from less than $10 trillion to now with a notional value of $231 trillion just in the United States. I mean, it's 15 zeros. So
15 zeros. You're talking a quadrillion.
One quadrillion. I mean, I pause because I think, I don't know what that number means, really.
Well, I'm talking about spreading the risk.
But that's the global derivatives market.
Where's AIG now? Where's Lehman now? Okay, I mean, granted, AIG got an awful lot of bailout dollars, and some of these institutions did, but the risk itself was not eliminated. It was just broadened.
Right. Well, and I think this is what you end up with the speculative community. Given an opportunity of shedding the risk and sharing it with someone else, what do? Reduce risk across all of their bets, or know that they can increase their leverage and increase their bets because some of the risk has been deferred to another party. So in fact, what was intended to lower total systemic risk has increased it because individual companies say, it's not my problem.
Well, and even without the derivatives market, David, the mentality of the people right now, there's an optimism in the market that's amazing. I mean, one of the ways that you watch how people are responding to the markets and their fear of risk is just funds that make money when everything else goes down, like a bear fund.
But, you know, the RIDEX bear funds have the lowest investor participation at any time in the last 10 years. You couple that with the volatility index, which is your ratio of puts and calls, and what some people would call sort of a bear index or a negativity index. It shows you how many people are betting against the market or for a rise in the market. Kevin, when it gets to 10 to 15, that low number, you know what? Everyone's on one side of the boat, and they're betting that things are going to be very good from here, and there's no reason to have a short position out there to hedge risk against decline.
Well, David, systemic risk is one thing, but in a way, with these institutions that are taking on so much risk, we're redefining too big to fail.
But you look at your top four, whether it's J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, they still have the most exposure. This is according to the Comptroller of the Currency, end of year 2010. The numbers are just out. And you've got banks which have, on average, between $1 and $1.5 trillion in assets,
mm-hmm.
and yet all four of them have more than $40 trillion in notional value of derivatives exposure, with J.P. Morgan leading the pack, just shy of $80 trillion.
So you're talking they have $1.5 trillion or less actual real on the books money. or exposure, but their derivative exposure is 25, 30 times that.
Correct, Kevin. They are cumulatively a large part of that $231 trillion sort of domestic derivatives problem.
Four institutions.
Correct.
Plus
correct.
A few others make up a quarter of a quadrillion dollars of exposure.
But Kevin, if you again want to kind of look behind the scenes and see what's being done in politics and why things are or are not being done, follow the money. Again, whether it's the Tappy Pipeline,
right.
Whether it's going back to the Panama Canal a long, long time ago, Kevin, this is where the rubber meets the road. We have a derivatives nightmare in front of us, and it's not something that we particularly want to face because, we've talked about this in the past, Kevin, it's a little bit like a nuclear reactor. We had a meltdown with Chernobyl. Caused by what?
It was actually a safety check that triggered things.
So you have
in fact, you know what? It was the same thing with Apollo 13. They did a cryo stir, and then all of a sudden, boom, the side of the service module blew out.
Okay, somebody's following NASA, and I appreciate that it's you.
Once again, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. McIlvaney.com.
Kevin, okay. This is the issue. We've had the Dodd-Frank bill, which could have had teeth to help regulate this systemic and institutional risk problem relating specifically to derivatives. And instead, we've chosen opacity. Kevin, this is the same thing we did in 2004 when there were several congressional hearings dealing with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And guess what happened? Be quiet. Don't say anything. This is politically motivated. This is race-driven. Why are you all over Franklin Raines and his management of Fannie Mae? Kevin, in those hearings, they went so far as to play the race card and say that Fannie Mae should not be scrutinized. Any scrutiny that was being brought against the company was a direct result of what?
Racism.
Franklin Raines, the CEO and chairman, being criticized on the basis of race. Kevin, we've had the opportunity to be transparent. We've had the opportunity to look at the facts before there was a crisis, and each time we get close, there's a reason to not go there. We don't want to go there, Kevin, not with the derivatives. No, we don't, because we don't know what kind of worms we'll find in the can, and we can't afford to find out, because at this point, we're talking about something that dwarfs the national economy.
And it could cause a Chernobyl. You know, it reminds me, most people now who are listening have moved from the old TV to the new HD TV, and they're fascinating because, you know, when you're watching football, you can actually see the actual blades of grass, and I mean, it's amazing. But I'll tell you, some of these actors and actresses that I thought were just pretty darn good looking, I can now see their pores in their skin, and I can see the imperfections of the makeup, and it's like, ooh, this was not made for HD. And if you think about it, with the derivatives market, if we really zoomed in close, it's very ugly. It's not a glamour photo anymore.
Kevin, if you're looking at these four institutions, J.P. Morgan, Citigroup, Bank of America, and Goldman Sachs, they have credit exposure, Kevin, as a percentage of risk-based capital. That's Tier 1 and Tier 2 capital, which is very popular to discuss in Europe and within banking circles, which for Bank of America and Citigroup is roughly 200%, J.P. Morgan closer to 300%, and Goldman Sachs roughly 600%. Kevin, if you want to understand the risks inherent to the financial system, As they remain unaddressed, you have to look at the derivatives market.
Sure. Well, and you know, we've interviewed Richard Bookstopper a couple of times, and Richard was a key voice in front of Congress as to how to bring transparency to these derivatives. And actually, you had to have some consistency of what they are, but each one of these guys is their own unique kind of being. I mean, some of them are pages and pages of contract. How in the world do you bring transparency to something that's uniquely written?
It's uniquely written, Kevin, but you know, we think the world is small when we ponder the 7 degrees of separation. In the derivatives market, it's 2, perhaps 3 degrees of separation. You have Greenspan's speech, which we mentioned in 99 to the Futures Industry Association, where he said, these new financial instruments are increasingly important for unbundling risk. Kevin, what that neglects is the market reality, not the academic truth or insight that he may have brought, but the market reality, which is that if you can cover losses on the downside, speculation increases. So while in theory derivatives make the market a safer place by spreading risk across multiple institutions, in practice it becomes a license for speculation, and it ends up tying all financial institutions together, wherein if one is impaired, they all have exposure either directly or indirectly.
Well, David, just being a father makes me realize that, you know, these guys academically may think they're right, but as a dad, if I covered all of my kids' losses from this point on, it's going to increase risk. Okay, so real world or common sense sometimes trumps, you know, what's written about in long thesis for, you know, doctorates. But Here's one thing we do know. The academics love to come up with a solution that includes printing money. And then they love to academically tell you that it doesn't turn into inflation.
Well, Kevin, I mean, this is, if you read last week's Newsweek, Niall Ferguson's article in there, he says the Fed may deny it, but Americans know that prices are rising. Inflation is back. I can't eat an iPad. This could go down in history as the line that launched the great inflation of the 2010s. You know, it's eggs, it's milk, it's bread, it's meat. Kevin, these are the basic American foodstuffs. And guess what? They're all grain dependent. They're grain dependent. We've had not only the money printing on the one side,
right,
but we've had pork barrel spending on the other, creating this whole ethanol craze, Kevin, which is driving the price of basic foodstuffs, the stuff that we eat. Again, did you eat eggs this morning? Did you have milk with your cereal? Perhaps a slice of toast? Maybe you're the steak and eggs guy. Guess what? Now you've got double the expense, both on the steak and the egg side.
I'm just eating quail eggs. That's all I need to do. And I mean, why buy the full egg if inflation's making it smaller?
Well, the irony, Kevin, is that now pork barrel spending is driving the price of pork through the roof. A pound of sliced bacon costs today $4.54 compared to 2 years ago, $3.59. That's a 26% increase in 2 years.
Well, David, I just recently heard on the radio, it was BBC, that the IMF says that food prices have actually risen 36% worldwide over the last year.
Kevin, what's interesting is that we've got households who have less and less to spend, right, on basic things. And at the same time, you're in a pickle with Congress having to consider raising taxes. We're in a bind. We don't have enough money coming in. You've got to increase revenues. Cutting spending is probably not going to happen.
And they're not going to cut entitlements, Dave.
No. So, Kevin, what you have is basically a second or third act in the fiscal crisis nightmare. What we have, Kevin, is something that is unsustainable, both in terms of a rising cost of basic foodstuffs and basic expenses set against rising taxes. It has to happen.
Right.
It has to happen. And I'm not for it because I don't enjoy it, but I see that it's necessary to some degree. It was David Walker who suggested basically three parts cuts for every one part increase in revenue. In other words, increase in taxes. Well, the reality is they're going to ignore Walker now that he's out of office, just like they ignored him when he was in office. Kevin, that's probably medicine I could take. Three parts of a cut to current spending to one part increase in taxation. The point is, Thomas Donlan made this very clear in last week's Barron's article. Our taxes barely cover our social welfare programs. Basically, everything else is being put on credit. You look at our current deficit spending, you look at where current outlays are going, we are spending as much on social welfare programs as we have in income. We don't have enough for anything else.
David, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, so I'm going to let you be the bearer of bad news. And I hate to have people turn the program off just completely depressed, but would you just tell the listener how much they would have to raise taxes of each of the tax levels to even cover what we've already spent?
Not to catch up on debts, not to pay off the national debt, but just to pay our budget?
Oh, you mean what we're just spending right now?
Yeah, what we're spending now and can't afford, we'd have to see corporate taxes go from 35% to 88%. Now, 35% is an unrealistic number since there's so many ways that your multinational corporations get their effective tax rate to less than 10%. But assuming they were paying their way and they were at a 35% rate, that would have to be bounced to 88%.
88%.
Your top tax bracket for individuals would have to go from roughly 35% also to 88%.
So this is the wealthy, in quotations, from 35% to 88%.
Mid-tier income earners would have to go from 25% to 65%.
Hmm.
And the lowest tier 10% currently paid in income tax would have to jump to 25%.
So for those who are saying, let's stop printing money, let's stop throwing newly printed inflationary money at the system, that's the other side of the coin.
Right. Or you could look at this differently, Kevin, and say, well, let's stick it to the wealthy. Okay, they have so much money, they can pay. They don't need their income. They've got so much in assets. Just let them eat what they already own, and they don't need income. Kevin, if we tax 100% of the top 2%, which is basically anyone earning $200,000 a year and more,
right,
if we taxed that 2% at 100% tax rate, that would help us to the tune of $300-400 billion, which is a fraction of our current deficit spending. Kevin, I mean, the reality is we have to tighten our belts, and we're not willing to. And this is why we're not willing to. Government is not willing to because government is growing to the point where they are the Leviathan. They are the monster which is in the immediate future going to be consuming upwards of 60% of GDP, Kevin. You know, if you hearken back to Woodrow Wilson, he said, liberty has never come from government. Liberty has always come from the subjects of government. The history of liberty is a history of resistance. The history of liberty is the history of the limitation of governmental power, not the increase of it. And this is the problem, Kevin, because the fiscal crisis is compounding. We have the folks at Cato, Michael Tanner, who says that by the mid part of the century, we'll have 60% of GDP, which is going to go just for the operations of the federal government. Kevin, we're on a financial death march.
You know what it is? It's like an animal eating its own young. Okay, there's not going to be generations after that if they're eating their own young.
It's wrong, I think, Kevin, for us to focus on our current debt levels, because that's a smaller piece of the bigger problem. The bigger problem, again, going back to the Cato research and Michael Tanner, the larger disease, he says, is a rapidly growing government that's consuming an ever larger share of our national economy.
Okay, but if you've got everyone employed, okay, let's say that we have high employment numbers and a healthy economy, you probably could have tax increases, whether we like it or not. But our employment picture doesn't seem very clear right now, and it's certainly not improving.
No, in fact, a lot of the jobs that have been taken overseas are going to stay there. You look at multinationals. This was from Wall Street Journal. Since 1999, U.S.-based multinationals have eliminated 3 million jobs here in the U.S., while at the same time creating approximately 2 million jobs outside the United States. So the jobs eliminated were basically permanent replacements when they moved the 2 million overseas. And there were major efficiency gain and savings in terms of, you know, pension, this and that, medical. You look at the way corporate America is structured today, and it has made sense for corporations to move overseas with their operations. But the difference between 3 and 2 is 1 million, which is basically what they've described in the past as productivity gains.
Sure.
Those are gone. As we've improved technology, as we've created supply chain efficiencies, we've just eliminated a lot of jobs that didn't need to be there as technology has improved.
So we've talked about the reduced buying power of the dollar. We've talked about the need for increased taxes, and really, no matter how much we increase them, we're not paying the bill. Then we've also talked about employment, and that's a problem right now. It's not getting any better. David, there was a man that you knew before he died, 2004, he made a outrageous statement. His name was Sir John Templeton. Okay. And he said before the real estate fall was over that housing would fall, or the prices of houses would fall 90%.
Here in the United States.
And he said that when that happened, he'd be a buyer. Now, where are we in the housing market right now? We certainly have not had, in dollar terms, a 90% drop.
Well, and I think, Kevin, that I had to scratch my head back in 2004 when he made that statement, and it's begun to make sense as you've seen mild appreciations in real estate across the country. The price of the average single-family home has come down. But the price of gold or real money has gone up considerably and will continue to, Kevin. It's very reminiscent of the 1970s. Between 1970 and 1980, the average single-family home went, at the beginning of that decade, went from costing 600 ounces of gold to about 85.
Okay, so this is getting back to measuring in real values.
Yeah, but it was roughly an 86% devaluation of the U.S. housing market in gold terms.
Okay.
And then it returned from that 85-ounce level up to about 600, actually a little bit north of 600, starting 2000-2001.
600 ounces of gold for a median-priced home.
Now we're at 120 ounces, Kevin. We've seen an 80% depreciation. I mean, we're knocking on the door of Sir John Templeton's guesstimate of a 90% devaluation in U.S. home prices. Not in dollar terms, which is interesting because he didn't make that clear. But it has happened yet again. Now, maybe it's 86%. Maybe it's actually the 90% number that he called for. Kevin, what it implies is an easy target price for gold in the 21 to 2300 range, maybe with a spike to numbers that are half, again, as high as that, or maybe even twice that number.
Before housing is actually at the bottom.
But again, you don't have to see a collapse in housing prices nominally.
Right.
Maybe it's another 10, 20% decline from here in nominal pricing. So it goes from $180,000 to $150,000 or $130,000. But we're not talking about a collapse in prices, well, I guess, unless you're talking about Detroit. But, Kevin, we have in front of us significant opportunities, and I think it takes, in our opinion, a bird's-eye view to recognize the changes that are happening. We want to explore more in coming weeks, Kevin, what it means to take a bird's-eye view and see, as John Templeton did, what was a 90% coming devaluation in residential real estate in the United States.
Well, David, sometimes a bird's eye view, and you know I'm a private pilot, my house looks very different from above. And sometimes a bird's eye view really does require a completely different perspective than the day-to-day. And you were just telling me about some clients, some friends of yours, that are in real estate and in real estate development. They've done that for many years, but they do something very, very unique. They take a bird's eye view, literally.
Well, again, I know a man that learned this trade from his father, real estate development specifically. Real estate is, of course, about location, location, location. To grasp the importance of a locale or to judge a future direction of development trends, demographic shifts, what's unique about this family, Kevin, is that they consider almost on a subconscious level the topography, the distance, the elevation. And again, they do this by getting a bird's eye view. The family owns a helicopter and they regularly explore for future options by getting a bird's eye view of an area and seeing something that other people who 10 feet off the ground would never see.
So from a real estate developer's point of view, they're sitting side by side in a helicopter looking at the potential of the next great growing area that they can go into that maybe the guy on the ground never sees.
Yeah, it's almost as if, Kevin, geography shrinks with altitude. Relationships seem clearer between communities. Natural traffic flows are anticipated. Growth patterns can be seen as you're seeing cities and townships bust at the seams. Do you get those numbers from the town fathers and the economic numbers they're crunching?
Right.
Or is something as simple as getting in a plane and seeing what you see,
right,
does that make the difference? You realize, actually, between two cities, you can be spitting distance, depending on how the wind blows, if you're 5,000-6,000 feet out.
Okay, now, David, that brings me to a question for you, and just a response to a book that you put me onto that I really should have read many years ago. It's a book called The Fourth Turning, and it's a theory, as you know, of historic cycles. You know, we're talking about bird's eye views, but a lot of our clients are not real estate developers, and they're probably never going to fly a helicopter. But it seems that history has patterns very similar to neighborhoods from the air. If we understand the pattern, we can be ahead of the game, or even if we're not ahead of the game, we can be consistent to the season that we're in.
It is very similar, Kevin, to getting that bird's eye view. If you can enter the present tense and current events, not unlike what happened this week with Osama bin Laden,
sure,
but from a historical perspective, Kevin, I think what it does is it does the same thing as shrinking geography. You shrink history and you realize we're only a few generations from 1517 and the pounding of the 95 Theses under the door at Wittenberg, revolution, if you will, in theological and ultimately social and political regimes. Kevin, that's only six lifetimes from us.
Right.
That's
right.
Only six lifetimes from us. Very, very close. So I think to understand the present tense, you do have to get a little bit of an elevated view, and we can do that through looking at the cycles of history.
Well, and speaking of cycles, there are seasons within the cycles. And, you know, when somebody says, well, is this Osama bin Laden thing? Is this the epic changer? Is this the big game changer? In reality, if a person understands the season we're in, we realize, no, it's a blip in history.
As important as it may be,
it's not a game changer.
Not a game changer.
Okay, because there's spring, summer, fall, and winter. I'll use an example. If you don't understand the season you're in, you're going to be inappropriately reacting. My daughter lives in New York, okay? And my wife yesterday was packing a big box of summer clothes. Why? It's still cool in New York, but she understands the summer season's coming, so we're going to send Shay the summer clothes, and she's going to send the winter clothes back, not because right now she needs them, but she knows she will.
It's coming. Kevin, this book Neil Howe wrote in 1997, The Fourth Turning, we're going to explore some of these ideas with him. How can our listeners gain that bird's eye view to the marketplace and better understand current events in a historical backdrop? We'll look at that this next week.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.